Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. The Olympic Movement and the Road Ahead. Status quo, or will the International Olympic Committee tackle the big issues? This large question is posed by Dr. Stephen Wen, Chair of Kinesiology and Physical Education at Wilfrid Laurier University.
"It's very hard to undo the damage," commented a forlorn Francisco Elizalde in March 1999. "It'll linger. Let's talk reality. Our image is kaput right now," observed Elizalde, an IOC member to the Philippines. His prognostication was tied to the carnage of a media crisis that gripped the organization in the wake of revelations concerning methods employed by Salt Lake City bidders to win the right to host the 2002 Olympic Winter Games. Salt Lake City officials employed a slush fund to curry favor with a number of IOC members through an orchestrated gift-giving campaign in the years leading up to the vote held in 1995. Over 20 IOC members were implicated in a subsequent internal investigation. 6 were expelled, 4 submitted their resignations, 3 members were exonerated, while others accepted varying forms of censure. An exercised world media pursued the story with vigor. Rattled corporate sponsors pressed for meaningful reform, and the IOC, an organization ill-prepared to manage such a media crisis, scrambled to protect its institutional and financial autonomy. The ensuing calendar year witnessed substantive changes to the Olympic Charter to position the IOC to enter the 21st century as a rejuvenated and strengthened guardian of the Olympic movement. As we look back after a decade, it's clear that much more work remains for IOC President Jacques Rogge and his colleagues if the organization wishes to pursue its mandate at its fullest capacity and embrace its status as an international body. There's a clear choice to make within the walls of the IOC's Lausanne headquarters. Will the status quo prevail, or will the institutional resolve be mustered to tackle big issues? First, let's review some of the changes wrought by the Salt Lake City scandal that offered tangible benefit for the Olympic movement. With respect to the enormous challenge facing local organizers, there was a needed emphasis placed on improving the transfer of knowledge between successive organizing committees so as to improve their capacity to manage issues such as ticketing, security, and sponsor relations. Steps were taken to address the increasing size of the summer festival and the fallout for cities trying to successfully mount them by capping the number of sport events in the Olympic program. Efforts were made to bring greater efficiency to the operation of the Olympic Solidarity Program. Improvements were made to the IOC's internal and external communications programs, while sponsors and IOC-affiliated bodies drew comfort from enhanced transparency concerning IOC finances. National Olympic committees were charged with definitive oversight responsibilities concerning bids from cities located in their respective territories. An ethics committee was established to devise an IOC member code of conduct and to respond to allegations concerning improper conduct of IOC members in their roles as members or in their professional lives. This commission has been active, and a number of IOC members have been expelled or faced censure in recent years. A greater degree of non-IOC member representation on the Ethics Commission is advisable, but it's a start. Limiting IOC presidents to a maximum of 12 years of service in the role offers the prospect of more frequent infusion of leadership ideas. I'd still argue for 8 years as a maximum. The concept of term limits for IOC members was accepted, even though the renewable 8-year terms fell somewhat short of true term limits. All of this marked a step forward for the IOC in its search for renewal and regeneration in 1999, even though the IOC's harshest critics were underwhelmed by the reform package. Then IOC President Juan Antonio Samaranch also employed the crisis as an opportunity to push through his goal of making the IOC more broadly representative of certain Olympic stakeholders. The IOC's permanent size is now 115 members, with membership cohorts of prescribed numbers. 70 members are elected as individuals, while the remaining 45 members are drawn from the ranks of active athletes, National Olympic Committee, or NOC, presidents, and International Sport Federation, or ISF, presidents. On the surface, this represents an effort to reach out to the other members of the Olympic tripartite, namely the National Olympic Committees and International Sport Federations. However, the functionality of this new membership structure bears careful monitoring. For a body long susceptible to block voting, the potential for further Balkanization is worrisome. The newly minted ISF representatives have already lobbied for an expansion of the IOC in such a way that all ISFs on the Olympic program would be granted an IOC member. One could expect similar demands from the NOCs if the IOC ever granted this degree of representation to the federations. States Richard Pound, a former IOC vice president, the organization would become as cumbersome as the United Nations and equally paralyzed. But in this effort to restructure itself, what significant cohort was left on the sidelines? 10 years later, and in the wake of winter and summer festivals in 2006 and 2008, that witnessed female athlete cohorts of 38 and 42% respectively, the IOC's current female membership sits at 16%. And while this marks an improvement on the dismal figure of 6.6% female representation on the IOC in 2000, underrepresentation of women marks a clear problem requiring more attention. Nowhere is this more evident than in the current composition of the IOC Executive Board. It's long been understood in the IOC's bureaucratic structure, the 15-member executive board headed by the IOC president wields enormous authority. Only one member of the current executive board, Morocco's Nawal El Moutawakel, is female. Her work as chair of the 2012 and 2016 evaluation commissions is noteworthy, but is overshadowed by the absence of a woman in any of the four IOC vice president positions. While the IOC broke new ground in 1997 with the election of Anita de France as one of the vice presidents, and Sweden's Gunilla Lindberg served a subsequent term in such a role, today all four IOC vice presidents are male. In the wider Olympic movement, the problem of the underrepresentation of women in decision-making roles continues to confound sport leaders. A 31 December 2005 target for all NOCs and ISFs to have 20% of the positions in their decision-making structures occupied by women was missed by the vast majority of the bodies. Even in 2009, only 30% of the NOCs and 29% of the federations have met those four-year-old targets. There has been more progress in terms of opening up opportunities for women on the Olympic event program, with much of this progress occurring under Juan Antonio Samaranch. Still, observers have been scratching their heads at recent events. While the IOC will trumpet the recent addition of women's boxing to the Olympic program, no one's been able to adequately explain to this observer why women's softball was removed from the London Olympics and failed to gain inclusion for the 2016 Olympics. The fight for the inclusion of women's ski jumping in the Vancouver 2010 Olympic Winter Games and the ensuing legal challenges grabbed headlines around the world. Yes, the IOC has rules for the inclusion of sports, but the entire saga did little to support the IOC's claims that it's committed to enhancing the profile of women in the Olympic movement. The promotion of women in sport is a big issue. Will words be replaced by definitive action? Eurocentrism festers within the Olympic movement and offers another big issue for its current leadership to confront. Of the 46 Olympic festivals staged, 29 or 63% have been in Europe. Two of the next three scheduled games will occur there. If Madrid prevails in the upcoming vote for the site of the 2016 Summer Olympics, you can change that to three of the next four. The European voting bloc and the IOC can control the site selection process, and we need look no further than the 2008, 2010, and 2012 decisions for evidence. Vancouver's bid benefited from Europe's willingness to sacrifice Salzburg so as to set up a process that would yield a European host city for the 2012 Olympic Games. Europeans dismissed the popularity of baseball and softball in North America and Asia in voting for their ouster from the Olympic program. Sports such as handball and modern pentathlon, with strong bases of support in Europe, survived the review of the Olympic program in 2005. Seven of eight IOC presidents have hailed from Europe. Of the 35 international sport federations sponsoring events on the Summer and Winter Olympic programs in September 2008, 20 were led by European presidents and 31 had their headquarters on the continent. Power and influence in the Olympic movement is clearly tilted towards Europe. Now, it's folly to deny Europe's importance to the establishment and nurturing of the Olympic movement in its formative years. But within the Olympic world today, Europeans exhibit a troublesome sense of entitlement. When the Foundation Board of the World Anti-Doping Agency declared that Montreal would serve as the headquarters for the organization, a veritable firestorm swept across Europe. When Australia's John Fahey launched a late and ultimately successful challenge to succeed Richard Pound as WADA's chairman in 2007, the other candidate, France's Jean-François Lemour, cried foul and withdrew, declaring his intent to pursue the formation of a European anti-doping agency. Europeans sought a six-month delay in the election to find a replacement candidate for Lemour, who had been nominated by the Council of Europe. The Council claimed it was Europe's turn to lead WADA. Given the iron grip on the IOC presidency that Europe refuses to relinquish, the European call for a leadership rotation based on geography in WADA's headquarters was laughable. If Jacques Rogge convinces his IOC colleagues to elect a non-European successor, he will, in my mind, have secured a portion of his presidential legacy. Encouraging the IOC to break tradition and appoint a non-European president is only one way in which the organization can actually fortify its claim to be an international organization. It's time that the ambulatory mission of the Games includes South America and Africa. It's a major issue for IOC members to consider when they prepare to drop their ballots in the box at the vote on the site of the 2016 Summer Olympics in October. Tokyo is a wonderful city and a successful past host. But how can one rationalize sending the Games there for a second time and an Olympic festival to Japan for the fourth time before a city in South America or Africa has hosted them once? I like Madrid, but if the Spanish capital prevails, we will have had Olympic festivals in Europe in 2004, 2006, 2012, 2014, and 2016. Should Europe host 5 of 7 Olympic festivals? Chicago offers an opportunity to cash in on prospective Olympic revenues related to television rights fees and corporate sponsorship, given the attractiveness of the U.S. market, especially in these lean economic times. I still give it the edge as I record these thoughts in mid-September, with the IOC's session in Denmark 2 weeks away. But can we expect a better bid from South America than the one forwarded by Rio de Janeiro in the wake of its successful hosting of the 2007 Pan Am Games? It may or may not be Rio's time in the minds of IOC members, especially in light of concerns regarding safety and security. But the bottom line is that delivering the Games to South America or Africa must be a priority for the IOC, now or in the immediate future. The dynamics of the final weeks of this contest will be fascinating to watch. Confronting the underrepresentation of women in the halls of Olympic decision-making and the troubling Eurocentric tendencies of the organization should rest front and center on Jacques Rogge's agenda for his final 4-year term as IOC president. So too must the need to reach a fair and equitable solution to the continuing debate concerning the distribution of Olympic television and corporate sponsorship revenue among members of the Olympic tripartite and the organizing committees. There's a long history of conflict between the United States Olympic Committee and the IOC with respect to the formula for the distribution of corporate sponsorship and television money. The USOC currently receives more money from the Olympic Partners, or TOP, sponsorship program and Olympic television revenue than all of the other 204 National Olympic Committees combined. In the past, such an arrangement was governed by two realities. First, the U.S. government granted the exclusive rights to the use of the Olympic rings and other marks in the U.S. territory to the USOC by virtue of a U.S. piece of federal legislation, the Amateur Sports Act, passed in 1978. And second, the vast majority of top sponsors were U.S.-based, and the U.S. Olympic television contract dwarfed those from all other television markets. The IOC was forced to concede 10% of the U.S. television contract, later adjusted to 12.75, and 15% of the top sponsorship program revenue, later adjusted to 20%, to the USOC to permit television advertisers to use the Olympic rings on U.S. broadcasts and to ensure access to the lucrative U.S. territory to top sponsors. However, today, 5 of the 9 top sponsors are based outside of the United States, and the amount of television money flowing from Asia and Europe has increased in relation to the U.S. market. Still, it should not be forgotten that approximately 60% of the global sum of Olympic television and corporate sponsorship money still flows from the U.S. Much of the tension between the USOC and IOC dates back to two efforts by the United States Olympic Committee in the 1990s to lobby Congress such that the right to negotiate the U.S. TV contracts would be transferred from the IOC to the USOC. Obviously, American Olympic officials wanted the leverage to determine how much of the U.S. television money the USOC received and how much needed to be shipped to Lausanne for distribution to the National Olympic Committees, international sport federations, and organizing committees. At a summit meeting between the power brokers of both organizations in Cancun in 1996, an agitated Juan Antonio Samaranch clearly indicated that the IOC would not accept any further efforts to preclude the IOC from conducting business in the United States. Fast forward to 2009, and fearing that the lingering dispute concerning the distribution of Olympic revenues might have a deleterious effect on Chicago's bid, the two sides decided to defer discussions until 2013. But it was a fragile truce as the USOC once again tweaked the IOC's nose in announcing the launch of its planned Olympic television network, in partnership with Comcast, before all matters of concern to the IOC, most importantly its impact on longtime television partner NBC, had been resolved. They know we have issues. I just find it frankly cavalier on the part of the USOC. It's just vintage USOC, concluded a frustrated Richard Carrion, chairman of the IOC's Finance Commission. Jacques Rogge intervened in August 2009 and secured a pledge from Chairman Larry Probst that the USOC would delay any further development of the channel until all matters of concern to the IOC had been resolved. Jacques Rogge's job is to foster the necessary interorganizational trust over the next few years, which will encourage future dialogue dedicated to reaching a fair and equitable agreement concerning the distribution of Olympic revenues in the waning days of his presidency. And at the end of the day, the discussants must not lose sight of the fact that the bill for hosting the Games falls to the host cities and organizing committees. Now, I'm not one who subscribes to the belief that the IOC is capable of solving or is compelled to confront all of the world's problems. But I do believe that the IOC should be able to solve its own problems. And I've outlined the underrepresentation of women, Eurocentrism, and the distribution of Olympic revenues as lingering, big issues that require a renewed commitment on the part of the organization, and in particular its leadership, to resolve. With respect to Olympic revenues, no solution is possible without reasonable approaches from the USOC and the other 204 National Olympic Committees, and hopefully the necessary goodwill will be demonstrated by all parties, including the IOC. None of this is meant to diminish the need to maintain strict oversight of the Olympic bid city process and to continue the IOC's support of the fight against doping, or to prioritize the search for means to limit undue nationalism within Olympic ceremonies. All of these tasks are important. The IOC can and should do more to ensure the property rights of citizens in Olympic host cities. However, the three issues that I have identified as core items for Jacques Rogge's leadership agenda, if addressed with commitment and determination, offer a path for greater inclusiveness and equity for Olympic stakeholders in the 21st century. I'm Dr. Stephen Wen, a proud member of the Kinesiology and Physical Education Department at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario. I'd like to wish the citizens of Vancouver and Whistler, as well as Canada's Olympians and Paralympians, a positive experience in February 2010. Thank you for listening.
Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010, UBC Continuing Studies in collaboration with universities across Canada, and The Globe and Mail.